All right, let's do this thing. The journey to a failed podcast begins with a single click. So I've hit the button, and we're going to get this thing rocking and rolling. Episode one of Muthonomics. I'm not even too sure how to pronounce that yet. Is it Muthonomics, Muthonomics, Muthonomics? Hard to tell. But we're going to get going here. Episode one. I think what I want to, I know exactly what I want to riff on today. And if that's too much of an 80s reference, riff, well, you know what? Don't listen. I want to talk about venture capitalists. Woo! An entrepreneurial podcast on venture capitalists. I don't like venture capitalists. I think venture capitalists are, I think they're clowns. I just had my second experience within the last few months with venture capitalists, and they really, really bother me. They really bother me. Like, they rub me the wrong stinking way. Venture capitalists are greedy, gambling gatekeepers, is what I've come to conclude. 3 G's. How about that? We'll roll off 3 G's right out of the gate. Greedy, gambling gatekeepers. It's like they have the money and they want you to get down on your knees and beg and grovel and kiss their ring in order to get access to it. A few reasons why I don't like venture capitalists. They are, I feel like they speak out of both sides of their mouth. In my experience with them, they're hoop creating, productivity sapping gatekeepers. It's really, really what they are. And I'm convinced they don't have an ounce of creativity in them themselves. And so they kind of meter out, they try to govern. That's another great word. They're governing. They're like a governor. I remember growing up, my dad had a generator. Well, he had several generators, because they broke quite frequently. And sometimes he'd have generators that, you know, it looked like it was straight out of Home Depot. Like, it had the engine and the generator as part of the whole thing, and it had the pipe handles, and you pick it up and carry it around. Well, those engines always went out rather quickly. So instead of, after a while, I think he got tired of cycling through those generators, and he started to jerry-rig these old car engines. So, like, he would set up, I remember his setup eventually was he would get like an old Volvo engine for like $100. And he would set it up on, he created like a, you know how like engines sit on like the block, you know, and they have, they've got the engine mounts. Well, he created that out of like cinder blocks, and he would hoist this engine down into this cinder block holder and put like a push button start on it. And then off the fan belt, he would connect the belt to the generator. And then you'd go out there when you needed power and you'd push the button. And on the 1970 Volvo engine, and you'd have a push button start, and it would rumble and churn and grumble and get going. And then it would, you know, spin the fan belt, and the fan belt would spin the generator. And that's what would create electricity. You ran into problems when there was idling issues. So, like, a lot of those old engines, if you remember driving around in an old car that your parents might have had in the 80s, maybe even some of you in the 70s, the idling would get really rough, and so you'd have to heel toe it. We'd call it heel toe, like, especially if you had a stick shift. You'd have to have your heel on the brake, and then you'd have to have your toe on the accelerator to keep the thing from sputtering and dying. And so, you'd be sitting at a stoplight, and you'd be alternating between keeping your foot on the brake and trying to keep the engine going. And I guess if you grew up in a flat area, like Texas or Florida or someplace that's super flat, you wouldn't have had to worry about that. But growing up in New Mexico, in Albuquerque, a lot of the streets, they slope towards or away from, whichever way you're aiming. There's a pretty significant slope east to west in Albuquerque on most of the streets. So you'd have to heel toe it, because if you took your foot off the brake, you'd roll backwards into the guy behind you, or if you were facing east, you'd roll forwards into the guy in front of you. So anyway, so when the generator, it was a great setup until the idle control kind of went out, and then your voltage would fly through the roof. So you'd be sitting there watching TV, and if it was sputtering, if the idling went down, the screen would start to like pulse, like shrink, and it would get these big black bars on the outside of the screen, and it looked like it had like a heartbeat, and it was run, run, run. And then if the idle control went the other direction, the TV would get like super bright, and it was like on the brink of blowing things out because there was too much voltage getting created. Deep breath. Yeah, we went down memory lane. I don't know what that's all about. The heck was I talking about? Engines, generators. How is that relating to venture capital? Oh, the governors. They're governors. They don't have any creativity in themselves, and so they want to govern other people's creativity. So you come to them with this burst of genius or this burst of inspiration or this great prototype or a product that's actually at market, and they just want to sit back on their high and mighty trust fund horse and critique it and say, well, you know, in order for that to work, you need to modify it this way, and you need to do this way, and you need to change this. And I think it's like, you know what? Why? What are you doing? You have no creativity in yourself. So you are relegated to being a governor. What is that? 4 G's? They're governing, greedy gamblers. I forget what the what was the other G? It'll come to me in a second. But the greedy gambling part, the other thing that has bugged me about them, and I've only had two interactions with VCs in my time of doing business since I started my business senior year of college, 2004. So what, 13 years in? And I've made the mistake of interacting with VCs twice. But the greedy gambling part, they're not just like, hey, you know, I want 3-2 odds, or, you know, I want 9-2 odds, or 13-2 odds. They're Powerball players. So they, if they give you $1 million, they don't want $1.5 million back. They don't want $2 million back. They want $700 million back. And that aspect of it just really, really pisses me off, because they're not in it to build slow, substantive value. They're pump and dumpers. I mean, that's what the Wolf of Wall Street essentially went to prison for, was being a pump and dumper. He was a pumper and a dumper. He pumped up crappy penny stocks, and then he dumped them, and took huge commissions in the process. And those type of people on Wall Street were prosecuted, probably not as to the quantity, to the degree that they should have been. There probably should be like 80% of Wall Street in prison, but because they all cycle through Wall Street, the Fed, the Treasury Department, and the White House, you know, they all give each other a pass. I knew it. I was going to try to get through a podcast without a political reference, but I think it's going to be too difficult for me. A lot of Wall Street should be in prison, a lot more than they actually are. But that's illegal, technically, to pump and dump something. But my run-ins, it sounds like, hold on, I got a parking reminder. Yo, I'm not there anymore. Thanks for the reminder. Clear that. Clear. No, I don't want to extend the session. Okay, good. I didn't take full advantage of that parking session, so I left like 85 cents on the table. Probably not the most efficient use. So yeah, the co-working space that I'm at, that I've been at since 2012, over 5 years now, they sold their parking lot to a South Florida developer, and they're currently building, they started construction about a month ago on some condo high rise. To the credit of the co-working space, they have tried to make alternate arrangements. At first they said, well, you can park in the parking lot adjacent to the co-working space in the parking lot of a Church of Scientology. Well, that lasted about 3 seconds before that modified into, you can park there, but it's $10 and you can only park there for a maximum of 2 hours. Well, that doesn't really work. Like, when you go to a co-working space to work, you park, you walk in, you set up, you've already burnt through 10 or 15 minutes. And then that gives you an hour and, what, 40 minutes before you've got to pack everything up and then head back down to the parking lot before you get towed. So no, that's a fail, not working. Then they tried a thing where they swung a deal with some people who owned a lot about a half mile west of the joint, and they had a shuttle. And that lasted for about a week. And I tried it once. It wasn't too bad. You parked there, and then you waited for the shuttle. And it was a nice Mercedes van, so you hopped in, air conditioning, you know, nice chit-chat with the driver. And then you're at the front door, and you walk in, you work for whenever, and then leave. So that wasn't too bad, but that lasted a week. And then they sent out an email blast that said, for things outside of our control, my guess is they probably didn't have a shuttle license. That's the only thing I can conclude. Or they didn't want to pay for the Mercedes van anymore. I don't know. So then they said, for reasons outside of our control, we can no longer do this. So an update is forthcoming shortly. So they sent out another update last week, and they said, now we are offering free Uber rides. And I was like, what are you guys doing? Like, so I haven't pursued that because they didn't offer any details. I was like, Uber ride from where? My house? My house to the co-working space is typically a $9 Uber fare. So you're going to pay $18 a day for me to drive to your place? I doubt that's what it is. It's probably like free Uber rides from like 50 yards down the street would be my guess. So I haven't wasted my time trying to uncover what's going on there. So I've found a little pocket, which shall be unnamed, but I found a little kind of off the beaten path public parking space that runs the Park Mobile app. And typically parking in downtown is, I don't know, what is it? Probably $1.50 an hour to $3 an hour, depending on where you go. It's not super expensive. But this place is 85 cents an hour. So I locked up 4 hours earlier today and then left a little while ago and just got the notice that I had 5 minutes remaining if I wanted to extend my session. Well, no, they wouldn't have been notified. I was going to say maybe I could have done a good deed and paid it forward and extended it for like another 4 hours and let some schmo sit there and park for free. But he wouldn't have known that he could park for free. And so then the city would have been getting double paid, which they probably were already because I still had an hour left. About 45 minutes left when I left. And they're tied to the license. But that's probably not going to work. I don't think you can pay forward digital parking. They're not going to let you do that. So the city is currently collecting double 85 cents an hour on that slot. I don't know. This is rambly. This is rambly Rambleson. VCs. What is this podcast even about? It's about the fact I didn't like VCs and I'm talking about parking. Why am I talking about parking? Co-working. I don't remember where I was going with this. So maybe I'll just recap the experience that I've had with VCs. My first run-in with VCs was back in 2008. And I started my business in 2004. And it was primarily a web and branding company. Shocking. That's so groundbreaking. You started a web design development and online branding company. I've never heard of such a thing. Explain it to me, Mr. Muth. So at the time it was, you know, maybe, I don't know, a dime a dozen, and now it's probably a dime per 1200. Everybody is a founder or co-founder of some unique, patented process, unique creative approach, thinking outside the box, blah, blah, blah. If I read somebody who thinks outside the box one more time, I can't believe that phrase still even exists. So many people are outside the box that people should be clamoring to get back inside the box to be different. Maybe that'll be my new pitch. I think inside the box, because now that's the opposite of being outside the box where everybody claims to be. So anyway, I started my business in 04, senior year of college, and considering that this is episode uno, I'll give you a little backstory. I was working at a design firm beginning in 2001 as a junior designer and then got promoted to a designer and then actually won an award as an art director, got published in the Rockport Publishers, Power of Paper and Graphic Design Part 2, as an art director. And I quickly realized, I was going through business school at the time, and I quickly realized, wait, we're billing these clients tens of thousands of dollars for these branding projects, and I'm getting paid a measly 12 bucks an hour. Didn't take Einstein to put two and two together and say, yeah, I think I'm going to go start my own business, which I did. So I bounced and I started my own business in 2004, doing largely the same thing, branding, with a special focus on web design because I was young and hip and new flash back in the day. So put that in your pipe and smoke it, people. Good old Flash. I actually opened up Flash the other day because it's part of the whole Creative Cloud suite. And I was like, you know, I'm going to upgrade to the whole kit and caboodle. And I opened up Flash and I was like, wow, it hasn't changed a lot. Like, it's almost exactly the same. You got the timeline and the tweening. The tweening was actually a little bit harder because they were trying to automate it more. And it was throwing me for a loop. Like, I liked clicking on a keyframe and specifying what I was going to do, not kind of relying on weird shortcuts that they had implemented. I'm sure if I spent 5 or 10 minutes in it, it would have made more sense. But yeah, I poked around it and I was like, that's funny. It's almost exactly the same. And yet I don't see Flash on any sites anywhere, so I don't even understand how it's still a thing. Must be like PowerPoint upgrade or something. Instead of doing PowerPoint, you use Flash. I don't know. That's something to Google. Where's my iPad? Maybe I should Google that. Hey, assistant. Google that. Research assistant. Google this so I can continue talking about VCs. Okay, thanks. I will. So anyway, in 2008, after 4 years of running my business, I concluded, made the observation again, wait a second, all of my creativity is helping drive sales for my clients' businesses, but I don't see any of the longer term rewards from that. So I'm in a continual toilet bowl whirlpool cycle of continuing to have to go get new clients and then find the spark of creativity again in order to keep my lights on and the internet turned on. And I thought, I don't like this model either, because when I have creativity, I want to have some stake in the future benefit of that creativity. I want to see some of the rewards from that creativity much more so than just trying to parlay the new portfolio item into convincing another company to come use me and my business creativity. So in 2008, I decided to make the leap into having a business that wasn't dependent upon continually getting new clients to use my creativity, but instead I made the shift in focus to try to employ my creativity to build a business for myself, which ensued 4 years of absolute failure. Stumbling, bumbling, missed expectation after missed expectation, 18 months of suicidal despair. I mean, it was ugly. It was ugly. And that's a thing that needs to be shared. And I think it's one of the reasons I'm starting this Muthonomics podcast, is to just be blunt and honest and candid about what actually happens when you set out to start your own business, when you set out to be an entrepreneur. It sucks. Like, there's a lot of hard crap. And we love Mashable and Wired and all these people. They love taking professional photo shoots of these people and putting them on the cover and saying, how this man turned $10 into $10 million in 10 days. You know what? Shut up. Stop taking the exceptions and or absolute con jobs and setting them up as the standard for everybody else. Because everybody else is grinding it out. They're learning along the way. They're failing along the way. They're stumbling and they're bumbling. And their expectations are missed over and over and over again to the point where it feels like Chinese water torture. And you just want to bang your head against the wall and say, God, make it stop, please. For the love of everything that's good and holy, make the missed expectations water drip stop. Because it's grating my soul into oblivion. I wish that was hyperbole, but it's not. So anyway, 08, I was like full of youthful vigor at the time. Now I'm full of old man naysaying. No, I'm just full of more caution. I'm calloused. I've got calluses, so I don't feel the pain of missed expectations as much. So in 08, I decided to leave the design business and try to set out on this journey of creating businesses with my creativity that I would be able to reap longer term rewards from. And so I sought out the help of a really good friend who is older than me, but a very, very good, wise, smart, savvy businessman. And we had an idea that we played around with for a few weeks, and one day the light bulb went on. And I had bought the domain name Scooped, S-C-O-O-P-D, a very Web 2.0. And for those of you that don't know, Web 2.0 was hot back in the day. 2005, 2006, 2007, it was like Web 2.0. And if anything was named Web 2.0, it seemed like people were just throwing money at it. So we said, all right, let's do this. New Mexico had just started some sort of VC incubator fund, and people were clamoring to try to get some money out of them. So we spent about a month putting together a concept for a site called Scooped.com. And it was going to be a video-driven site where users could upload their advice. So Scooped, like the inside scoop on stuff, was kind of the branding pitch of it. So if you're from New York, you'd get on there and you say, hey, you know, I'm so-and-so, and if you want the best hot dog stand in Manhattan, well, you need to go here. And if you want the best, you know, New York-style pizzeria, then you need to go here. So that's kind of the idea, like just open it up to people to give other people the inside scoop. So we took this to the VC firm, and the gentleman that I was working with, partnering with us on this, he knew the guy. So we had an in there, so he granted us a meeting. And we sat down with him and we gave him the pitch. And he was like, hey, you know, this is great. I like it. You know, it's kind of a fresh take on YouTube. It's real focused on, you know, trying to share inside knowledge. Your hidden expertise. I like it. I like this idea. So he gave us a checklist item of things to do. You need to go and you need to specifically write down how much money you're going to need for getting it to proof of concept, how much money you're going to need to, you know, what kind of team do you need to develop the technology and to launch the site, and how long will you need and all this stuff. So he gave us a list, and I went back. And my personality is such that I just say, hey, let's just make it. Like, let's just do it. We already know what the technology is. Let's just do it. And that'll impress them. So I spent the next like 3 or 4 weeks working with, I think it was called, what was it called? FFmpeg? Was that what it was? FF something. And it was an open source video publishing platform that you could install. And it was actually powering Vimeo at the time. I think Vimeo had just started, and it was the core technology behind Vimeo. So I spent the next 3 weeks just plowing through, learning that thing, getting it set up, and designing a rough site. And we launched it. 3 weeks later, we launched this stupid site, Scooped.com, and we blasted it out to about 300 friends and family, and we said, hey, here's the deal. If you know stuff that you want to share, go and do it. And within a week, we had like 80 users, and there was probably, I don't know, 20 or 30 videos where people had posted. And I thought, man, this is it. Like, this VC cat is going to be blown away that we have gone from zero to proof of concept on pennies, literally 3 weeks of my time and, you know, a couple hundred bucks for some server space. And we had a proof of concept. So we set up another meeting, and it wasn't even just a proof of concept. It was a stinking beta launch. It was a launch with users that were posting videos. So we took this back to the guy, and I went in just ecstatic. I was over the top ecstatic about the meeting. I thought for sure he was going to look at it and just be blown away that, you know, because they're always talking about, we want the entrepreneur that can prove that they can bootstrap and they can prove that they can push through resistance and get things to market. That's what they always pitch. They're so full of crap. But that's what they always tell you. So we go in, and instead of giving him a piece of paper with, hey, here's our plan and here's our date of launch and here's blah, 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 we need this guy and director of technology, that guy, I just opened up my laptop connected to his Wi-Fi and loaded the site. And I said, yo, homie, we launched it, dog. look, we've already got users. There's people posting videos. And I'll never forget how betrayed I felt. Instead of him being like blown away, impressed, he got super defensive and super critical and super accusatory. He instantly launched into, oh, wow, this is cool, but well, now what do you need the money for? He's like, I thought you were putting together a case for what you needed the money for. And it hit me. I was like, wow, people that play in this space are, they're liars. They're just flat out liars. And this was confirmed more recently. Not lying in they're liars in that they inflate stuff. They say, oh yeah, I need 1.5 million bucks to get to launch. And you don't. I think that's what I came away with it from. You don't need that. But in order to get it, you have to go along with the lie in order to have a shot at getting the funding. And it was just, it was really disenfranchising, a very disenfranchising experience. And I don't know if that's because it was Albuquerque and Albuquerque sucks. No offense, 505 peeps. But there's a reason they call it the land of entrapment. I mean, don't get me wrong. Scenery beautiful. Food off the chizane, okay? To use a little bit of geezerly Snoop lingo. Have you seen the new show that Snoop's on? I was like, holy grandpa Snoop Dogg. That guy looks like leather. And he's still kind of trying to dress like a pimp and be cool. Hilarious to me. But, so, beautiful scenery. Off the chizane food. And people there that are just genuine New Mexicans, they're some of the best people you'll ever meet. But the genuine New Mexicans are corrupted. I guess they're not corrupted, but it's not just genuine New Mexicans. You have to deal with, on a daily basis, people who came from towns called like Hobbs and Lovington and Roswell. And all these podunk stinking towns were literally the number of cattle outnumber the people. And they think that Albuquerque is their Shanghai. Albuquerque is their Tokyo. And you have to deal with those people. And it is just mind-numbingly painful. I remember this one woman that I had to work with on a couple projects over the course of about 18 months, and she was from one of those small towns, and literally she thought that Albuquerque was like the financial district of Manhattan. And I was like, you realize that people show up to our meetings in like cowboy boots with like horse dung on them and a toothpick in their mouth, right? I mean, they're not in $10,000 suits showing up in a Rolls Royce. Like, stop treating this like it's Manhattan. It's freaking Albuquerque, for crying out loud. So I don't know if it was the Albuquerque per se that caused that guy's reaction. I don't know if it would have been different in San Francisco. But being from Albuquerque, you're totally cut off from San Francisco. People in San Francisco look at you in Albuquerque and they laugh their heads off. They're like, "What is this clown doing? If he was worth anything, he'd already be in San Francisco." I'm not gonna, you know, I was married, two kids. I'm not gonna uproot my family and go grovel at the money trough of Silicon Valley and beg for validation. It was a good idea, and I executed it in a very efficient, short manner. And I did not get the response at all, even anywhere in the ballpark of what I thought I was gonna get. So that was a very disheartening, kind of betrayed feeling. So then he, you know, he kind of recovered and he said, okay, well, that's great. You know, like I said, I thought he was gonna be super impressed, and he just was sort of like kind of bummed out that we weren't, you know, that it was already there. And he was like, no, he's going to pierce the veil. That's what it is. Venture capitalists remind me of Mr. Incredible's boss at the insurance agency. They're going to penetrate the bureaucracy. They don't want real entrepreneurs that can put their head down and take a concept and an idea to actual launch mode for pennies and in a very short period of time. They want, because that penetrates their bureaucratic charlatan crap. This is exactly what it is. Venture capitalists are, whatever his name was, Mr. So-and-so with the, you know, short guy with a long and the tooth look and the aligning his pencils on his desk. How is it, Mr. Parr, that all of the clients of InsuraCare know the inner workings? They're penetrating the bureaucracy. That's what they are. They don't want entrepreneurs that can actually get crap done, take things to market, and begin to iterate instantly, because it shows that all of their funding is bloated and it's inflated. So yeah, don't get me started on venture capitalists. I loathe venture capitalists. They piss me off. And it started with this experience in 2008. So he gave us a list of, well, now you need to come back and show who your tech team's going to be. You know, you need to find somebody. And he even told us, maybe find a YouTube guy. Maybe see if you can pull a YouTube guy over to give the idea some validation. And I was like, what is this, high school? Like, are we trying to put together a homecoming court? Like, I don't understand. The idea's there. It's executed. People are uploading videos. Like, what the heck? So yeah, it was a bad experience. And so we went back and we jumped through hoops and we put together an ask. And he kind of hinted a few times. He was like, you know, and make sure that you're asking for enough money to justify it to the investor, because the investor wants a return. And, you know, so if we ask for $100,000 and we're going to turn back $500,000, he doesn't want that. And it's not enough for him. So he kept kind of hinting at that, like, ask for enough to make it appealing to an investor. So we went back and forth for the next 3 months on financials, and we hired an accountant to help. And, you know, my hot-headed youth at the time was like, screw this guy, let's just make this thing work. And the older gentleman, who I respected and still do, and we still remain very good friends to this day, you know, he was more pragmatic. Hey, no, you know, let's do this. You know, they have reasons for, you know, giving us dollar targets, and, you know, they do want a specific return. Let's just jump through the hoops and do it. So we spent about 3 months putting together detailed financials, like spreadsheets and who our advisory board was going to be. And we tracked down, worked every connection we could find to try to, you know, get quote unquote YouTube certified people on board. And we came back to him later that fall and presented it to him, and we decided we were going to ask for $12 million. Why? Because that's sort of what they were expecting us to ask for. And I mean, we came up with all kinds of ways that we were going to spend the $12 million. We were going to buy a Mini Cooper and put a, you know, scoop the ice cream. The logo was an ice cream cone. We were going to put an ice cream cone on top and drive it around the country and have like a GoPro. I think it was a GoPro at the time. There was some sort of flip cam. I think it was GoPro. But it was a very portable camera that you could quickly take video and then, you know, interact with it, upload it. So we were going to go on a cross-country Mini Cooper thing and, you know, go collect video around all these different cities and go on a 50-city tour and all this stuff. So we come back in, we pitch the marketing plan, we get to the final ask, and we say, hey, you know, hey, it's going to cost us $12 million. And he flipped out. He was like, what do you need $12 million for? And we were like, we just explained it in 75 pages worth of crap that you asked us to produce for you, Mr. Venture Capitalist Man. So at that point, I was just exceptionally pissed off. And I was like, dude, these people are gatekeepers. They want you to get down on your hands and knees. They want you to beg and ask for advice and grovel at the trough of their check stroking. And I was done. I was like, screw this guy. No, we don't need this guy's money. I don't know what he is, but he's not impressing me. So I was like, forget that. And at the time, I was still in that mode of, you know, if you can't land big money or go viral overnight, then you abandon the idea. I mean, it was the whole pivoting thing, which I've grown to detest as well. Oh, if you're not successful within 3 months, then you have to pivot. And that was kind of the mentality back then. And it was definitely my outlook on business, regrettably. Because I think looking back, it was an idea that if I would have had some patience and persistence and been in it for the long haul, you know, the concept made sense. The brand was consistent. The pitch was consistent with what we were trying to do. But so we abandoned it. I mean, we shuttered the site and that was it. So fast forward, that was 2008. Fast forward, where are we at? We're at 35, 34 minutes, 35 minutes. I'm trying to keep these things under 45 minutes. So fast forward to 2017, have since relocated to Florida, and I got invited to this week. I got invited to a state of entrepreneurship in Florida presentation that was done at a local university here. And so I was like, hey, that sounds cool. You know, I mean, these people at the university, they are paid to research. So you would expect that if you're paid to research, you know, they're going to dispense some good information, because it was the, you know, the annual recap of the state of entrepreneurship. So, really super fancy building, College of Entrepreneurship that they recently completed. Amazing facility. They said the building's like $44 million, and they put $22 million of it in the entrepreneurial floor alone. So it's tight. I mean, it's the coolest space I think I've ever seen. As far as, you know, a space that's promoting entrepreneurship, it's very, very cool. And keep in mind, within the last 3 months or so, at the urging of a couple close advisors and a relative, my father-in-law, you know, they've been pushing me to seek growth funding, because I've been running two software products, GoToWP and WooCredits. GoToWP for 5 years and WooCredits for two and a half. And there's customers, there's paying customers. I mean, you know, there are, GoToWP is in 102 countries. WooCredits is currently, I just sold one in the United Arab Emirates. Got a first buyer there. So WooCredits is in 37 countries now. So both products are doing well, and both products continue to expand and grow. And so, you know, a couple close advisors and my father-in-law said, hey, you should go back into the game. You know, we know that you don't like it. You think that the VC game is a fraud. But you should at least feel it out, because some growth capital might help, you know, accelerate the pace of growth for your two software products. So I was very hesitant, and I thought, well, you know what? I have matured some since 08. I'm not as idealistic, you know, and I went into it with the expectations that the VCs haven't changed. So I did reach out to two VC funds here in Tampa, and one specializes, or at least they promote themselves on specializing in technology. And the other one is not as technological, but, they are, they do have a little bit of technology arm related to their fund. So I went to their sites, and they have an inquiry form where you can, you know, send a general inquiry, and you describe the product and link to the product and send sales maps and stuff. So, because they're all very clear, we want post-revenue products, post-revenue. So I did that. You know, I sent a geographical sales map of, you know, hey, this thing sold in 102 countries, this thing sold in 37, blah, blah, blah. You know, here's the potential market. There's 22 million WooCommerce users, you know, log me in with GoToWebinar claims that they have well over 1 million users. So there's an opportunity here. Crickets, absolute crickets. And it didn't surprise me. It's what I expected. So crickets. And I'm not going to grovel and beg and make 19 follow-up phone calls. You have an inquiry form on your site looking for potential investments. I give you some very basic, solid, straightforward facts. You don't want to get back to me. That's your deal. That's your problem. I'm not going to waste my productivity chasing down your ring to kiss, jackasses. So that's my approach. I'm going to continue to develop the products. I'm going to continue to service my customers. And you guys can do what you want. It's laissez-faire, right? So we go to this thing, and we go into the auditorium, and it's beautiful and amazing. And the dean gets up, and she gives a nice introduction. Very, very brilliant lady. Very bright. Her research is amazing. And then she turns it over to, lo and behold, one of the partners of VC firm A that I had sent an inquiry to. And he gets up there and proceeds to BS everybody. Oh, we love technology, and we're all about investing in local lone wolf entrepreneurs, and we blah, 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 blah. And I'm going, yeah, okay, whatever, dude. Maybe my email didn't go through. And then he turns the floor over to the director of the other VC fund here, that I had sent the inquiry to. And same exact crap comes out of his mouth.
Oh yeah, we're looking for post-revenue, and we even invest in pre-revenue, you know, we'll invest in proof of concept.
And I just was sitting there going, this game is so disingenuous. They're so dishonest. It's such a smoke and mirrors, productivity, hoop jumping, time wasting endeavor. And I think they prey off of, here's the bottom line. They've created a cottage industry that preys off of people who want to be entrepreneurs. It's not an industry that actually serves real entrepreneurs. It's a cottage industry that profits off of people who want to be entrepreneurs. There's a huge, huge difference. If you're an entrepreneur, you frankly get it done. Okay, I drove a forklift at 1 o'clock in the morning for 18 months to offset revenue downturns when the economy bombed. But guess what? I kept my freaking business running. Okay, I taught tennis lessons on the side to offset downturn in revenue during the Great Recession in order to keep my business alive. Okay, this isn't, I want to be an entrepreneur. I love the idea of entrepreneurship. I want to create products and be creative and try to generate wealth and drive the economy forward. I just love the idea, and maybe I'll be famous one day and be on the cover of Fortune magazine if I just, you know, network correctly. No, I got crap done. Real entrepreneurs get crap done. And I'm looking at the audio levels right now, and they're like maxing out. It's like I've lost throttle control on my dad's old generator. So if I've just punctured your eardrums, I apologize. If you're currently bleeding profusely from your, your auditory cavity, whatever that's called, ocular, no, that's your eyeball, whatever, your ears. If you're bleeding profusely from your ears, I apologize. But that's the bottom line. And that's what entrepreneurs need to know. The VC, and like I said, maybe it's different in Silicon Valley. I would like to hope that it's different in Silicon Valley. But I've never been there, so I don't know. And Tampa's trying. Like everybody wants to kind of be, oh, we're going to be the next Silicon Valley. All right, I read an article of Akron, Ohio was trying to be the next Silicon Valley. Let's be honest. Akron, Ohio is not going to be the next Silicon Valley. Okay. Oklahoma City, oh, it's a tech hub. No, it's not. It's not a tech hub. It's a tornado funnel. It's a tornado magnet with an overrated basketball team. So I don't know if it's different in Silicon Valley. I hope that it would be. But here's the thing. I mean, I've been doing this since 2004. Real entrepreneurs, they don't sit around wasting time, effort, and resources groveling at all of these greedy, gambling, gatekeeper buffoons. They block them out, they put blinders on, and they actually go develop the product. And they sell the product, and they service their customers. And they do it on a bootstrapped piece of crap budget, because that's what entrepreneurs do. So yeah, it just really, really rubbed me the wrong way. It brought back it was like 8 years of, I had forgotten about all that stuff for like 8 years, 2008, 2007, 9 years. I had forgotten about all that stuff for 9 years. I was just happily creating and growing and building. And then all of a sudden I get invited to this thing, and it's like the exact same dude. It's the same story, the same pitch. They talk out of both sides of their mouth. Yeah, we're looking for post-revenue companies. So I raised my hand, and praise God that he gave me grace to actually hold my tongue in its entirety. It did get a little loose, but it wasn't too bad. I even asked the guy that went with me. I said, hey, did I get a little too pissy? And he was like, no, not at all. I thought it was a good question. So towards the end, I asked what I was hoping was going to be the last question, and it turned out to be the second to last. But I raised my hand, and they gave me the microphone. It was probably, I don't know, 100 people in the room, 150 people in the room. And then they had an overflow room with another 100 and some people. And I said, how exactly do you define pre and post revenue? Because in my experience, post revenue is a very ambiguous, convoluted, hard to nail down category. And he said, well, you know, yeah, you're right. He goes, that's the easiest question we've gotten tonight. And I even prefaced, I said, this might sound like a overly simple, stupid question. But I said, how do you delineate between those? And then he just went on this rambly tangent of, well, you know, yeah, we're not just, I mean, you know, it's not just one sale. We kind of want to make sure that, you know, it's got some traction and some, you know, that it has the potential to grow. And I said, so, I said, theoretically speaking, if there was a dashingly handsome young individual here who, let's just theoretically say, had a software product or two that had customers in anywhere from, I don't know, 37 to 102 countries and had been generating sales for the last 2.5 to 5 years, would that be something that would merit further discussion with you guys? And he was like, oh, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And the part that what my tongue was held on, I wanted to say, well, then respond to my email, jackasses. But I didn't. And I said, okay, great. Yeah. All right. Great. Cool. So then the thing shut down and they dismissed everybody. And the dude, like, was waiting to see which way I exited the room. And he went sprinting in the opposite direction. And it was fine with me. Like, I didn't want to talk to him either. Because I see through the veil of your charlatanry. And I don't want to participate in it. I really don't want to participate in it. And I've come across enough entrepreneurs who are actual entrepreneurs to know that this trait is what makes an entrepreneur an entrepreneur. An entrepreneur gets through obstacles. And they persevere through hardship. And they do it while eating ramen, if necessary, and driving forklifts at 1 o'clock in the morning for 18 months. So it's not unique to me. But as you go about your business, ask yourself, are you really an entrepreneur? Because that's going to be the defining trait that makes you an entrepreneur, is the ability to break through obstacles and to actually get things done and take products and ideas to market. So I have doubled down on my anti-VC stance. I want no part to do with VCs. They're greedy gamblers. I had like 15 G's that I was thinking of earlier for them. They're greedy, gambling, gatekeeping governors of creativity who just sap productivity. And yeah, I don't want any part of your game. I don't want any part of your game, and I'm not going to step foot in your circles ever again. So you can go on creating a cottage industry, profiting off of telling people how to be entrepreneurs. And while you're doing that, the rest of us who actually are entrepreneurs will continue to slowly build value and probably one day create something so successful, the table's going to be reversed and you'll be begging us that you can be a part of what we're doing. And I'll just say, oh, yeah, yeah, that sounds good. Yeah, uh-huh, yeah, sure. And then I'll never return your phone call or your email. So go pound sand. And I hope this inspires actual entrepreneurs to go be entrepreneurs. Like, drop some steely ones on the table and go have some unction and some resolve and some thick skin and some intestinal fortitude. I remember, last thing I'll say, a quote from, I think it was the Intel CEO right after 9/11. And of course, after 9/11, the economy and the markets were all over the place. People were very, very bearish. And he said, somebody asked him, how do you weather a storm like this economically? And he said, it takes a cast iron stomach. And I tucked that away in my memory banks. And I thought, you know what, that dude, even though he's the CEO of a ginormous enterprise, that dude hit entrepreneurship on the head. You got to have a cast iron stomach. So here's to having a cast iron stomach. Here's to developing a cast iron stomach. Here's to being persistent, patient, productive, gritty, grind it out, be patient, be in it for the long term. Don't look to pivot so quick. I've come, and I'll do a future podcast on this, but I've come to associate pivoting with quitting. So stick with it, have some gumption, people, and let's prove all of the VC fake business culture wrong. Oh boy. I know the people that are actually in that industry are going to be like, this guy is an absolute, complete, contrarian, whatever. But you know what? I see through your veil. Have a good day. Peace.